It was at the end of the day, and I had my son with me, and I was putting him in the car seat, in the car, and he was doing that arching back thing and being hard to maneuver into the car, and he was 4 years old. And I was doing that pregnant with my second son, and all of a sudden he says to me, "Hey, Mama, why is that lady smiling?" And across the street from where we were working at this homeless center, there was a strip club called the Classic Cat, and there was a huge poster outside of a woman in a cat suit. And, you know, scantily clad, smiling, you know, just ear to ear, cat ear to cat ear. And I looked at him as he said it and looked up there, and I just thought all of a sudden how that question kind of broke my heart. Because I thought, you know, someday my little boy is not going to ask that question of why is this grown woman in a cat suit on a poster smiling. That it will, you know, blend into the whole landscape of how women have become commodities and are bought and sold for less than you can buy and sell probably a pet cat. And so as I was driving home, I thought, I'm done thinking about it. I want him to know that I did something on behalf of women and that he's going to be able to love and respect women. And we're going to start this, like, tomorrow. And that was it.
That's Becca Stevens, the founder of Thistle Farms in Nashville, Tennessee. For 20 years, Thistle Farms has been helping heal, empower, and employ women survivors of sex trafficking, prostitution, and addiction. Today, you'll hear how Becca's personal journey of healing, what she calls love's meandering path, has helped launch a true movement across the country and around the world. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell stories about people who do amazing things for others, and I'm your host, Brad Shaw. Becca Stevens was born on April Fool's Day in 1963. When she was 5 years old, her parents packed up their five kids and moved from the Northeast to Nashville, where her father, an Episcopal priest, was starting a new congregation. That same year, her dad was driving home for lunch with the family when a drunk driver in a semi-truck smashed into his VW Beetle. A church member who saw the accident rushed to Becca's house to alert the family, but by the time her mom got to the hospital, her father was dead.
I think that the death of my dad when I was little impacted me more than I know. I think I'm a lot like him and I don't even know him, but just through the stories and the longing that I had for him, I think it had a huge impact on the choices I made around school and careers. But also, you know, I used to dream of my dad. That's how present I wanted him to be. So I would like conjure him up in dreams sometimes, just every now and then through the years. And those were like this big gift where I got to be close to him for just a little bit. And I also think when you grow up in the South, especially if your dad was a pastor, people do a lot of like, you know, oh, we prayed for a miracle or we, you know, hoped it would go differently, or, you know, they made it like this faith issue. And I always knew that that wasn't what faith was about. I mean, if you have a semi-truck ramming in to a Volkswagen Beetle, there's not a lot of chance. It's a law of physics, and it's sad and it's tragic, but it made me want to have a deeper faith, a faith that was about loving people and compassion, but not about these platitudes that really don't mean anything or prayers that just seemed hollow.
The tragic death of Becca's father was quickly followed by more trauma that would have an equally profound impact on her life. As the church community gathered around Becca's family to provide love and support, the church elder who stepped in to take over her father's roles became close with the family. But the closeness quickly turned into sexual abuse, the first incident with Becca taking place in the fellowship hall of the church during a spaghetti dinner.
He, you know, really took advantage of my family and me and, you know, abused me sexually for several years, and it all started in the church. So in some ways, it was a really kind of startling way to wake up into the world is, you know, the death of your dad and then an abuser coming right in on the heels of that.
And here's Becca on the impact that abuse had on her as a child.
I was really defiant. I was also really scared of a lot of stuff, I think, when people weren't around. Like, so I looked brave at school, but I was scared to get to school. I was scared to stand at the bus stop. And I think that's what happens a lot of times when kids are, you know, abused or thrown into violence. It's like you trade your innocence in for fear. And I could be fearful of things that I don't think anybody even knew. but I did have a defiant spirit with authority in many, many ways.
Becca went on to graduate from University of the South as a Phi Beta Kappa math major. She then went on to Vanderbilt Divinity School, completed her seminary, and was ordained as an Episcopal priest just like her dad. But even that faith-based path wasn't an easy one for Becca, given her deep-seated distrust of authority and that fear she talked about.
It's been hard in some ways because, you know, I'm an Episcopal priest. So you have a bishop, and all those relationships over the 25 years I've been ordained, it's been a little bit rocky. I've had some great experiences, but it's been hard. I remember going through seminary and thinking, okay, my goal is not to cry when I have to go talk to the bishop. And I never achieved that goal when I was in seminary.
You cried every time?
Every time. Can you imagine how that is so sad?
Why did you cry?
I think because, I mean, it was very authoritarian, and it was very, I don't know what the word is. It was so close to my heart. You know, like with all the stuff I had gone through and all growing up, God was never my problem. It was like this loving presence, this feeling of well-being. But the institution was really hard for me.
During the first week of her seminary, Becca met her future husband, Marcus Hummann. She was running a transitional housing program at the time, and one of the families had moved out, leaving an apartment filled with lice-infested furniture. Their first date was loading up the furniture and taking it to the dump, and the two have been together ever since. They were married 3 years before her ordination and now have three sons. Marcus went on to become a successful Grammy-winning songwriter, writing top 40 hits for the likes of Tim McGraw, Rascal Flatts, and Winona Judd. Rebecca says that throughout her adult life, she's always been drawn to the underdog and the social causes that help people in need.
That came from my mama. She did always love the underdog. And, you know, that's who you root for, and that's whose team we're on. And she cared for kids in this community for 30 years before her death, who were, subject to the violence and vulnerability of poverty as well. I always thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be a champion of people.
The idea for creating a sanctuary for women started germinating in Becca's mind during her seminary. In her book Snake Oil, The Art of Healing and Truth-Telling, she said she just didn't like the way women on the streets were being treated by the very institutions set up to help them. She started visiting women in jail to better understand their journey and how best to help.
I wanted to do it out of my faith and out of love. I wanted it to be a free-standing, open community where anybody could choose their path of spiritual well-being. And for some people, that means not doing anything. For other people, it means they become whatever denomination or faith they feel led to. But I wasn't going to be in control of that.
It was early 1995 when Becca had that epiphany with her young son next to the strip club. As she said, that experience was the impetus to take her desire to help women on the streets and turn it into an actual program. She filed for 501c3 status, found some friends who agreed to be on the board, and one who donated a house, and raised startup money from her husband's friends in the music business. In August of 1997, she opened Magdalen House, a residential program designed to offer a completely different kind of support for women transitioning off the streets. Magdalen now has five residential homes in Nashville, along with two transitional homes for graduates. Since its founding 20 years ago, Magdalen has helped hundreds of women find sanctuary from the streets and begin healing, and dozens of sister communities across the country have adopted their model.
We have 100 women on our waiting list. We have women from every state that want to be a part of this community and want to join in this powerful witness for how love heals for women who have histories of trafficking, addiction, and prostitution. And we have about 40 sister communities now around the country that have adopted this model. So the way women get there to any of these communities, including ours, it's a pretty, you know, universal story that individual women just bear on their backs. You know, it starts in childhood trauma. On average, the women that we serve are first raped between the ages of 7 and 11, and they hit the streets on average between the ages of 14 and 16 years old. They have experienced, you know, the inside of prison walls. They have endured the underside of bridges. They have survived the backside of anger, all of it. And, you know, when they come to us, most of the women don't really have hardly anything but some hope. And so they come, and the first thing that happens is they're allowed to rest. Just go to bed and relax. This is your space, your place. They start going to groups, you know, whether it's trauma therapy groups or prostitution groups or life skills classes or financial classes, parenting classes. They go to classes 3 days a week, and they go to IOP, which is intensive outpatient therapy, to start learning about what their triggers are and what their addiction is. And then they go to a doctor and a dentist, and they get assessments and find out, like, how much damage has been done to their bodies and what do they need to have happen. They find a therapist, and they begin to have a safe place to say, you know, we're not just talking about healing from the streets. We have to go back a lot farther than that, because nobody at 5 or 6 years old thinks what I'd really like to do is be prostituted around the country. You know, that's not anybody's ideal way of living. So what happened along the way where that was the result? And so what we say is, really, people say, you know, it's, you know, the choices women make. And it's like, if that is the choice, what were the options, right?
Becca quickly realized that just completing Magdalene's 2-year residence program wasn't enough to complete the road to recovery.
Yeah, I mean, we have women who, you know, their records started at 8 and 9 years old for truancy. And there are laws now that are helping so that women who have been trafficked, you can have your records expunged. But those felonies, they're hard to get rid of, and they prevent you from housing. They keep you from jobs. Women were coming in, they were doing great. They were doing so much. They had forgiven so much. They were healing so much. But they were not getting hired. I mean, we could not find jobs. And it was like, okay, well, we'll just start a company. How hard can it be?
Before she could start a company, Rebecca needed to figure out what sort of products to make and sell. She wanted something that reflected the transformational work that was taking place at Magdalene, something intentionally meaningful that would not only provide jobs for its graduates, but also help the healing last. That something turned out to be handmade essential oils.
Obviously, I didn't know a lot about a lot of bath and body care products. I've been at divinity school. But also, you know, 100% of the women we serve report rape. And so to make something that's really healing for the body made sense to me. And that we were going to remember our bodies and remember that they are beautiful and beloved, and to lavish them with something beautiful. And essential oils made sense. And it was so healing.
Now they needed a name.
So Thistles, you know, we named it Thistle Farms, because when we were going down to the streets and the alleys where the women were walking and turning tricks and sleeping, or even to the prison, the only flower left growing was the thistle. And it can grow through concrete and grow through chain link fences. And so the idea was, you know, to restore that flower's name. You know, it's a noxious weed, and it does. It has these amazingly thorny stems and leaves, but it has a deep, soft purple center. So it's a good symbol and a good reminder of how all of us have some pretty prickly exteriors, but we also have this, you know, beautiful, soft purple center. And so it was a symbol, and the idea of farms is something growing. But over the years, we started making paper from the thistle, and we realized that, you know, it's got this beautiful, fine down in the middle, and it makes strong and good paper. And so we started collecting it, and I think it was probably 8 or 9 years into the journey, I was out in one cold January morning just trying to find some wild thistle somewhere, because you can't grow it anywhere. It's illegal to grow it. And out on the side of the highway, I'd found a place that hadn't been mowed down, and there was some dead thistle in it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. And I went out there, started to pick it, and bent over, you know, with my little grocery sack. And about that time, a car came by and slowed down and had this, like, really worried look on their face, you know, like, oh my gosh, what's this woman doing? I just laughed and thought, oh my gosh, I have turned into a thistle farmer. I have become a thistle farmer, and there's probably nothing lower in this world that you could achieve. And then I was just so grateful. I was like, all that stuff I went through, you know, as a kid, and all the side roads I took, and all the mercy and forgiveness, and all these great opportunities that have come my way have led me right out here to be a thistle farmer. And it means that I got to be a person in this world that can look at a half-dead field of thistle and see some bountiful beauty. And not everybody sees it that way. And I was so grateful for the eyes that I have, and thinking, you know, when you're a thistle farmer, the whole world is your farm.
Today, Thistle Farms is so much more than essential oils. It's a thriving social enterprise that makes and sells more than 50 handmade natural products, including body lotions, hand soap, candles, room sprays, shaving gel, and a new organic bug spray. 30 to 40 Magdalen residents and graduates are employed directly by Thistle Farms at any given time, something that helps them gain financial independence and learn valuable skills in manufacturing, packaging, marketing, and sales. This year, Thistle Farms will pay out more than $1 million in wages to its employees. One of them is Jen Klinger, and her story is like so many heard within the walls of Magdalen.
I only finished the 8th grade fully. I did go for a couple months in the 9th grade, so I had no education. I didn't have any real job skills. I had my body, my young, firm body. There's a world out there that says, you know, it's okay. It's okay to there's a billion-dollar sex industry, you know. And I thought it was okay. But every time I sold myself or put a drug in me, a piece of my soul died, and it evolved into 20 years of homelessness, jails, psych wards, IV heroin addiction, no teeth. I didn't smell good. I didn't look good. I was jumping in strangers' cars knowing that I could possibly die and I could possibly be raped. And you get to a point when you're right there on the streets, in the thick of it, in that darkness, that you grow accustomed to rape and to the thought of maybe possibly dying.
Thankfully, Jen found her way to Magdalen through a pastor she reached out to in desperation after she attempted suicide. She graduated from the residence program in 2012 and is now employed as a customer service specialist at Thistle Farms.
You know, being on the streets, you have to be shut down quite a bit, you know, and just to really start opening your heart is not an easy thing when love came to you in some brutal ways in your life. So here comes a stranger saying, I believe in you. I love you. We're going to walk with you through this. And you kind of stand backish. And then after so many years, you know, I got a long way to go. But I know that they are walking with me.
Thistle Farms' impact is now being felt worldwide. Through shared trade partnerships with more than 20 manufacturers in 18 countries, Thistle Farms Global connects women producers directly to customers by distributing and selling their handmade products, like tea from Uganda and scarves from India. These efforts employ another 1,400 women worldwide. But back here in the U.S., with all the systemic issues that continue to work against the women that Thistle Farms helps heal, I asked Becca what we're actually doing right as a society.
The thing we've done really well is we have started using the word trafficking. So now we don't refer to girls who are 14 years old on the streets selling their bodies or being sold by people as prostitutes. We get that it is an injustice being perpetrated on them against their, you know, ability to fight it. And when you make kids addicts early and get them hooked on a lifestyle and in fear and in trauma, they're vulnerable. So the good thing is that there's this new language around trafficking where all of a sudden we realize the connection between a criminal and a victim. And how most of the women that we have criminalized were victims way before that. And we can have compassion again. And we can start writing legislation that actually works. We can start having systems that are less bureaucratic. We can shorten prison sentence. And when we do that, we are being about a healing process for the women. And they remember, it's like, oh my gosh, it's not just me. This is a pattern. And we have, you know, perpetrated this pattern. And the more you have real survivor leaders out there speaking and sharing that story, the more the whole culture starts to change.
In her book, Snake Oil, Becca uses lots of food and nature imagery and analogies to bring her story to life. Clovers, willow and maple trees, casseroles, crabgrass. She laments how modern mock apple pies pale in comparison to those made from scratch and says that most people want their healing to be like a mock apple pie, quick and easy. Why is healing so hard?
Well, you know, I mean, I think people think of healing as like miracle cures, and that's not what we're talking about. You can't, you know, touch somebody on the shoulder and all the trauma and all the pain go away or the arm grow back. It's not how it works. You know, healing is, thank God, much deeper and precious than that. You know, it's not a sideshow act. It is this intentional walk for all of us towards wholeness and towards, I think, you know, the original wholeness and grace that we were born with. It shouldn't come easy. It shouldn't come without a cost. It shouldn't come without intention. It should, you know, it's a gift, but we work with it and to be mindful of it And it's not like just this entity. You can't buy it in a box. It's not like that. It's this gift that's for all of us. I mean, everybody. There's nobody that doesn't get that gift. There's healing at deathbeds. There's healing at births. There's healing all along. So it's a really broad way and a really intentional way of thinking about this beautiful gift of healing. Doing crazy good turns for others is a gift. Oh my gosh, there's nothing better in my mind than to feel like you've done some good in this world. That's great. You can go to sleep at night. You can get excited about waking up in the morning. You don't have to feel burnt out. You can feel inspired. It gives you a lens through which to experience faith. It makes you feel like a good mom. It's the biggest gift in the world.
I'm Bradshaw, and thanks for listening to this episode of Crazy Good Turns. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about or donate to Thistle Farms and to submit your ideas for extraordinary people and organizations we should feature. And stay connected with us between episodes by following us on Facebook and Twitter. This season, we're excited to announce that we're giving a $50,000 grant to the nonprofit that does the most to creatively spread their Crazy Good Turn story, a virtuous and self-reinforcing circle of gratitude. We'll announce the grant recipient at the end of this season. Crazy Good Turns is audio engineered by Stephen Key. Music supervision and mixing by Score in Los Angeles. Research and editing by Martine Chaussard. And a special thanks to Megan Basinger. Take care and let's connect again soon.
I think Love Heals is probably the simplest way of stating a mission I've ever heard. It's a hope. It's a to-do list. It's a promise. It's poetic. It's practical. It's all of those things. It's just the way that you can understand that there's always the hope of healing in our lives because love is always present.